So the topic of the shiur tonight is obedience part of Kibud Av V'Em. What I want to do is construct a vision of Kibud Av V'Em, which explicitly addresses the question of the limits of children's obligation and not just of the extent of children's obligation. I want to be upfront, first of all, that we're not talking before the children get too excited. But all right is that, first of all, that there is a I think a mistaken impression that needs to be overcome often, that Kibud Av V'Em is about small children or teenagers. So Kibud Av V'Em is a mitzvah for adults, because all mitzvot are for adults. So the extent that teenagers are adults, Kibud Av V'Em is a mitzvah for them in the same way as it is for everybody else. But it is not primarily a mitzvah for it is certainly not primarily a mitzvah for children under bar mitzvah, because they don't have mitzvot. And it's not primarily a mitzvah for teenagers. Therefore, it's not a question of negotiating a relationship between people of radically different life experience. Right? The really complicated issues of Kibud Av V'Em are what happens when you have when you've hit equivalent stages of life experience, or even when you get to the age where the children, in some ways, have more capacity, more current experience, whatever it may be, than the parents, and figuring out how you maintain a relationship which is defined by the halachic parameters of kibbud and yira, when you no longer have presumptions of greater knowledge or dependencies financially and all that. That's really the kind of issue that I want to figure out. There is relevance, of course, for teenagers, but the first thing is not to think of Kibud Av V'Em as a mitzvah that you grow out of. Kibud Av V'Em is a lifetime mitzvah. Secondly, I want to say that I'm framing the issue in terms of obedience, and there are two ways to address that. One is the formal question: is there a mitzvah to obey your parents? Right, you know that if your parents, just straightforwardly, if your parents say to you, "I would like you to spend the rest of your natural life attempting to achieve cold fusion," do you have an obligation? Do you have an obligation to obey that, whether or not you are a physicist? Or on a much simpler level, if your parents say, "I would like you," right, your parents say, "Fetch me a glass of water now," right? Is there a mitzvah simply because they asked you to do that and you are obeying? And there's a second question about the extent to which obedience might be entailed by other obligations. It might be that you have an obligation to make your parents feel good. And most parents feel better when children obey them than when they don't. Some parents might enjoy a good argument. Right? So if the mitzvah is obedience, right? So even if you have a parent who enjoys opposition, right? So unless you have some kind of implicit notion that when they say, "Fetch me a glass of water," what they're really saying is, "Argue with me about fetching a glass of water," then you should obey. But if in fact your parents will feel much better, let's say your parents, I don't know, have these Kantian issues, right? They don't like using people as a means rather than ends. So you know they don't really like, right? They don't really want you to listen to them just because you said it. So then you might have other issues. They actually feel much worse after you obeyed them, because they will feel that they've betrayed their deepest principles. Probably most of you don't have these issues. I do, but this is my problem with waiters in restaurants. Always deep, deep philosophic problems. Some of you may have these issues also. But right, that's just a way of illustrating the technical issues. Okay, so with that, I want to start by pointing out that there is a complex of five different psukim that govern the relationship, the obligations of children towards parents. And we're not talking tonight about the converse relationships of parents towards children, right? Although part of presenting the issue as a whole would be seeing that there are reciprocal obligations. But just talking about the relationships of children towards parents, so you have in Shemot repeated in Vayikra and the differences in Dvarim, and the differences between the two versions of the Aseret HaDibrot do not matter to us tonight, where it says you are told to be Michabed et Avicha et Imecha. Right, so there's an obligation called Lichabed. Lichabed literally is to add weight to give gravitas to. We often translate it as honor or dignity. But those are imprecise translations. I translate it with a slash, right? Honor slash dignify as a hendiadys to try and give you meaning between them. But literally, right? Again, it's to make them heavy. Then you have in Vayikra, you have an obligation of yirah, ishimo v'aviv tira'u. And then in addition, you have prohibitions against striking in such a way as to draw blood halachically, prohibitions against cursing. But cursing, we should point out etymologically, is the opposite of lechaved. Lechaved is to make heavy, and lekalel is to make very light. Right, so there's an obligation to make heavy, a prohibition against making very light. And then there is a very peculiar thing in Dvarim 27:16, where we have in this ritual that took place on Har Grizim and Har Eval, there is a statement, cursed is the person, and here we don't have who makes very light, here we have who makes light their parents. Right, so we have two obligations that are framed positively, an obligation of kibud, an obligation of yirah. We'll bracket the prohibition against striking, since that's usually not relevant, only shows up in one context. There is a prohibition against making very light, and a prohibition and a curse against those who make light. I will point out that the verse, Deuteronomy 27:16, makes no appearance whatsoever in halachic literature between the time of the giving of the Torah and the late 19th century. But when it shows up, it's a doozy. So I want to put it there to begin with. Okay. So that's our list. We'll note that what is clearly missing is an obligation of love, right? Which may or may not be important. Right? Yirat Hashem is something we know. Kibud in other, we have other contexts of obligation of kibud, but we have ahava. Right? Usually, right, when it comes to God, we oppose ahava and yira. When it comes to parents, we have no obligation of ahava at all, and we have to try and figure out what that means. And there is no direct obligation, which says obey. All right, there's no verse which says you have to obey your parents. So the question is obedience entailed by one of the other obligations? So let's take a look at the Talmud's attempt to define kavod and yirah. So if you take a look at source number 2, the Gemara in Kedushin cites a Braita, and the Braita asks the question very directly: Eizehu morach ve'eizehu kibud. Right, what is the meaning of the obligation of yirah, and what are the instantiations of the obligation of yirah, and what are the instantiations of the obligation of kibud? So it gives us for yirah, it gives us the following statements: one, you don't stand in your parents' place; two, you don't sit in your parents' place; three, you don't contradict your parents' words; and four, you do not participate in an argument which your parents are engaged in, even if you engage in it on your parents' side. I'm going to explain it the way Rashi does. To be machrio, to be machria, is to assume that your parents and somebody else are on a scale, and you are somehow weighing the scale, and it doesn't matter which side of the scale you're weighing. Right, you're just participating in the argument. Okay, whereas kibud is defined as giving food and water, clothing and covering, escorting in and escorting out. So, let's start with yirah. Well, we'll start with kibud. Is obedience anywhere there in kibud? Food, drink, clothing, shelter, escort, not there. What about yirah? Is there anything in yirah that tells you that you have to do what your parents tell you to do? Yes, Jason. Lo sotera dvarav. All right, so we could say not to contradict their words means not just to intellectually disagree with them, but to in any way behave in such a way that makes their that contradicts their words. Do you find that compelling?
No, I'm just suggesting one could.
Right, so you could read it that way. You could read it that way. All right, yes, Judy, you have a different one? Is not what?
Isn't that covered? If you can't participate in an argument that's very involved, wouldn't that already preclude sotera
dvarav? So one includes the other. You can't contradict them.
Right, that supports a different reading of sotera dvarav.
Uh-huh, okay.
Or it supports a different reading of lo
machria. Okay. Okay, so you could try and read it that way. Rashi seems, we're not going to do an extensive analysis of Rashi's position here, but Rashi seems to suggest that the verbal obligations of kibud nira only apply to Torah conversations. Right, Rashi's explanation of Veina Machrio is if your father and some other scholar are engaged in a Torah conversation, you should not get involved. Which seems to suggest that it is very far from an obligation of obedience. It's an obligation of formal respect in the context of conversation. Furthermore, the Gemara in other places says that if your parent makes an error, what you are supposed to do is ask them whether they did not teach you the opposite. Right, so the obligation is defined in terms of formal verbal disagreement. You're not supposed to say, that's wrong. You're supposed to say, didn't you teach me the other way? But it doesn't in any way imply that substantively you're not allowed to disagree. Right, it's an expression of form. So it's actually very challenging. It's actually very challenging to define that obligation as an obligation of obedience. It can be done. It has perhaps been done on occasion, but it's very challenging to do it. There is, however, another way of getting obligation into the Braita as follows. When we ask the question, what is kibud and what is yirah? So there are at least two ways of understanding that question. One way of it is saying is that the universe of obligations of children towards parents is essentially occupied by kibud or yirah. And so if we can define, right, everything is either kibud or yirah, and the purpose of this braita is to define these two separate spheres. And if that were the case, then anything which is not in the braita is simply not included. The other possibility is that the braita works on the assumption that almost all obligations of children towards parents are included under both yirah and kavod. And the question of the braita is, what are those things which are uniquely yirah as opposed to kavod, and what are those things which are uniquely kavod as opposed to yirah? And in that case, things which are left out might be both. All right, so we don't actually, right, so actually the best way to get yirah into the obligation, right, into the sphere of obligations is to claim that it's not in the braita at all for good reason, because it's the most obvious thing. Of course, you have to listen to your parents, both for kavod and for yirah, and all the braita is trying to do is define the places, the places where they are apart. All right, so let's leave those two possibilities at least, right, hand that either obedience is the junction of kibud and yirah, or obedience is somehow totally left out by kibud and yirah. So the Gemara records a fascinating dialogue about which Rashi understands as being only about kibud, although we could fairly ask whether it applies only to kibud or it applies to yirah as well. The Gemara's question is, Michel mi? Who pays? Now that's a really interesting question. Why would I think that the obligation of kibud av-aim is something which is paid for by parents? And that's the two options the Gemara gives. Does the child pay, or do the parents pay for kibud av-aim? Now do you understand the possibility that the mitzvah of kibud av-aim, normally, when I have an obligation towards you, I would think that the obligation is on me, and I bear all the expenses of that obligation. But here the Gemara suggests, and then rules, actually, though it's kind of it's a sort of funny line. The Gemara says the rabbis ruled for Rabbi Yirmiyah, and some people say for the son of Rabbi Yirmiyah, that the father has to pay. Right? You can see that it makes a big difference, right, who asked the question and who got the answer. However, this is one of the jokes that does not seem to have been gotten by later halakha. We just take it seriously. Right? So we're going to say all later halakha takes the position that we rule Mishal Av, that parents bear the expense of Kibud Avein. So what kind of obligation is it where the expenses are borne by the person towards whom the obligation is directed, as opposed to by the person who has the obligation? How do you understand that? Yes, Rob?
It means it's going to be a balancing act for the parents, because they have to control how much kibud they want.
Because it could cost them a lot.
Because it could cost them a lot.
Okay, that's an interesting thing, right? It's an inherent control that parents can't... ask for too much. We'll have to figure out what kind of expenses do they have to bear. Right? For example, if we set an arbitrary rate that kibud av-aim can be billed at, say, $2,000 an hour, Right, thinking about how the aim would be, you know, all parents would be desperately discouraging their children or saying, no, it's quite all right. I don't really need you to do that for me right now. Anyway, yes, Andy.
A twist of language where it's just saying, you know, look, it's how much effort you spend for raising your kids is how much respect or how much rather you're up or a couple of things you're
uh-huh. It's just to say that that's very nice, but it's not very halakhically definable. Right? You know.
I mean, is it truly taken literally? That it's actually looking for
halakhically, it's taken absolutely literally. As parents, children could look at you and say, "Well, you know, you raised me for 30 years. You know, I think that I, you know, that obligates me till 60, and then they walk away." Whereas I'd rather not do that. But I think I understand what the temptation is. But I think it's right. But again, that's not the way it's been taken. Halakhically, it's taken as a really serious financial claim, at least financial. Yes, Yudin.
Well, I mean, the other question is, what do you mean by the expenses? Like, uh-huh. Let's say the parent says, "Fetch me a glass of water."
Mm-hmm.
It's his water. Well, you would pay someone to go and get you the water.
Mm-hmm.
It belongs to you. So does that mean he has to pay the kid after he drinks the glass of water?
No, that's exactly right. Anybody know there is a mitzvah where that's the case? Right? What's the mitzvah where you can charge? Returning lost objects. Right, can you return a lost object to somebody, you can bill them for your time, and for your expenses. Or if it was an animal, you can bill them for their feed. Right, so we have a model, right? It's not as exotic as I set it out originally. We have a model for doing a mitzvah towards others, and that has a limit, right? If you find somebody's cat, and it will cost you, right, and you recognize that it will cost you more to take care of the cat than the cat is worth, so you sell the cat and you give them back the money. Right, rather than building up, if you're a corporate lawyer, right, rather than building them for every 6 minutes, taking care of the cat, right, you don't do that. Okay, let's take a look at how the Gemara says. Right, so the Gemara says Meitzveh. So the Gemara wants to attack the position Mishel Av. The way to attack it is by saying that we have a verse in Mishle which seems to define kibud as expense. Kabed et Hashem mehoncha. You should honor God. You honor God from your wealth. So the Gemara says, hang on a sec, if parents really bear all the expenses of kibud av v'aim, how could kaved et avicha v'et imecha ever involve, right, what expenses would parents, should parents, or the other Gemara says the other around, how could you ever fulfill the mitzvah of kibud, which we are defining as spending money for somebody else's honor, if your parents have to bear all the expenses? So the Gemara has an interesting answer. The Gemara says the answer is that, in fact, your parents do not have to pay you for your time. Right, bitul melacha. Right, if you spend time away from work in order to fulfill the mitzvah of kibud, then your parents don't have to pay you. But presumably, they do have to pay you the material expenses. So if your parents said, "Can you please fetch me a glass of water?" or "Can you buy me a quart of milk from the grocery?" So you cannot bill them for your time driving to the grocery, even if that means taking off time from work, but they have to pay you back for the milk. Now, what kind of sense does that make? Right, if you're trying to explain the law, right now I've given you parameters. If you're trying to explain the law, what kind of sense does that make to say that you can bill for one thing and not the other? Yes, Shlomo.
Well, if the mitzvah is to serve your parents,
mm-hmm.
so you're not going to bill them for that. That's the mitzvah. But the mitzvah isn't to provide them with food. That's their own concern, so they can pay for the food.
Okay, so I would, right, that's exactly the terms I would use. Right? That the chakira is the mitzvah of kibud a mitzvah of service or a mitzvah of provision? Right, is your mitzvah to make sure that your parents have stuff, enough to eat, clothing, right? Or is the mitzvah to behave towards your parents in a particular kind of manner, right? And there are nafkaminas. There are practical differences. What happens, for example, if your parents don't eat anything? Right, if your parents say, "Can you go get me a glass of milk?" The answer is, why don't you ask Bascom or right, whoever, right, or Raffles, or whoever it is, who your household servants are. Is there any mitzvah for you to do this yourself, as opposed to having your parents do it? Now, if you define the mitzvah of kibud av v'em as providing service, then it is plausible to say that there is an element of obedience built into it. Right? Because the mitzvah is to behave in a manner that you have a certain kind of relationship. And that relationship, right, if we want to define it literally as a servile relationship, that might very well involve an element of obedience. But if the mitzvah is simply to make sure that your parents have stuff, right, then it's very hard to say, right? You can just provide it, right? It's nothing to do with what your parents want or don't want. You just have to make sure they have stuff. Now, in this outcome, right, the outcome here is since we rule that the mitzvah, that it's Mishel Av, so that means that we rule that the mitzvah is service rather than provision. Right? There is no mitzvah to provide for your parents as such. We could complicate that in some other context. We don't have to tonight. But there is a mitzvah to provide service to your parents. And now the question is the mitzvah, are the examples in the Braita, where it says to feed, which we will now mean as to serve at table, to drink, which will now mean to pour, right, to pour their wine, right, to clothe them, which means to serve as valet, right, or to escort them, right, to whatever, you know, to the opera, whatever it is, right, to make sure that they're not, right, that they are socially seen as being accompanied as opposed to be alone. So now the question is, when the Braita gives those four examples, is it just giving examples and say you should behave in all these ways, in all ways like this, or is it saying that the mitzvah of kibud av v'em is limited to these particular formal tasks? Right? And we're not saying, right, we're saying that we need you, right, we're going to mandate a particular set of activities that formally describe a certain kind of relationship, but nothing beyond that. Mm. Right? So that's a choice as well. Now we have to ask also, what are we trying to accomplish by this boundary, drawing the line between your parents can not make you pay for the things, but they can make you provide service. So if we're asking just the question, who pays for time, who pays for stuff, we have an answer. But the thing is, there are many other costs. Right? There are many other costs. And what happens when time is not just additional time, it's not just time that could have been spent working, it's time that occupies your, that really prevents your next career advance. Right? What happens if the amount of time your parents demand is such that you never go to work? Right? All those sorts of issues are not explicitly addressed. Okay, yes, you could end
the Nandi. Just quickly, the idea that you only have to pay for the stuff is conceptually very nice, because what's the source of your obligation to your parents is that they gave you your physical body. So it makes a lot of sense that you should have to serve them with your physical body, and they shouldn't have to pay for that. And they shouldn't have to pay with material possessions, which are to some degree pure.
I don't know. They also fed you lots of stuff, so I'm not so convinced that that's
no,
so neat.
If we say kibud av v'em doesn't apply to adoptive parents, it's a whole other issue. We should probably.
Oh, that's a different topic. Let's not. Right. I don't want to go there. Yes, Andy.
Just based on this boundary, yeah. I'm better off asking my son to build me a house than to buy me a house.
Yes. Right. So that's kind of right. Exactly right. So right, because that's the question is, what is the purpose of right? I might argue that the purpose of ruling Mishel Av as opposed to Mishel Ben is not just to make this conceptual boundary between provision and service, but it's to prevent parents from being able to completely control their children. Right? If parents could say to children, "I want that Corvette, buy it now." Right? That might give parents too much control. So we try and say, "No, you can't do that. All you can do is say, please come with me to the dealership." But even that, right? But that won't work, right? If you have parents who are fully controlling, right? So the question is, if you just see it as establishing a conceptual distinction, so then we don't care what happens in practice. But if you see it as opposed to that, if you see it as the beginning of an attempt to try and draw boundaries in the relationship, so we're going to have to draw boundaries around time as well as around money, and then we can really ask the question: what about psychological costs? What about health costs? Right, all those issues, right? Who really bears those costs? Okay, the Gemara has another really wild statement. There's a middle one which we don't have time to go into tonight, but the Gemara has a really wild final conclusion. It says, they asked Rabbi Eliezer, Ad heichan kibud av v'em, how far does kibud av v'em go? And he says, It goes so far that if your parents take a purse and throw it into the sea in front of you, that you shouldn't humiliate them. Which is kind of anticlimactic. And then, having said that, the Gemara says, oh, no, but don't the parents have to pay you back for the purse anyway? Right? It's Mishalav. So, first of all, it's not the world's best example. And having given not the world's best example, we then cut all the legs out of it. So the Gemara says, oh, no, really, because we're talking about a case where they're throwing their own purse away, and you're the heir, and when they throw the purse away, then really they're throwing your money away. And that's why you might get angry at them. right? That's a kind of undercut, you know, it's kind of a, it shows you how the position Mishalav really takes the teeth out of the rights of parents if you really use it to limit, right, to say that children don't have to bear any expense at all. Okay, let's, we can contrast that with the story of Dama ben Nassina version 2. This is source number 3, in which the rabbis ask the same question of Rav Ula they'd asked Rabbi Eliezer. They say, how far does Kibbutz Av Va'Em go? And he gives a sort of equivalent to the purse in the ocean. It's a famous story in which, you know, his father's asleep, and the sages come and they want to buy the stones for the breastplate from him, and they're offering him 600,000 somethings or other, and he turns it down because he would wake his father up. We are not told about whether his father ordered him to wake him up or not. This is one of those stories you shouldn't take with excessive literalness, because probably the father was really upset when he woke up. So I haven't yet met a parent who said, "Wow, I'd be really proud. I've been happy if my child turned down a fortune just so as not to get the key from under my pillow." But let's take it in the sense in which it's made. So he gives up all the, how far does Kibbutz Av Va'Em go? He gives up all the money in the world, and then furthermore, once upon a time he was wearing some kind of gold thing on his head and sitting amongst the elders of Rome, and his mother came and tore it off him and slapped him on the face and spit in his face, and he said nothing. Now that's really a lot more dramatic than just throwing your own purse into the ocean. But we also recognize that it is fundamentally incompatible with the claim that the mitzvah, or that parents have to bear all the costs. Right, the whole point of this, right? And that's why the Gemara says, even when it's talking about throwing a purse away, the Gemara says, hang on a second, that doesn't make any sense if the parents have to pay you back anyway. So here too, imagine the end of the story was Dama Nassina, right? He woke up his father and said, "Dad, I didn't wake you up. Let's please write me a check for 600,000 something or other right now, because after all, you bear all the expenses." Right? That's probably not the right outcome of this story. So we really need to think about what this story means. Now you could have a total allegorization of the story if you wanted to have fun, and you could say, who's the character in Tanakh who's good at Kibbutz Av Va'Em? According to the rabbis. Esav. Good, and what does Esav become in rabbinic historiography?
Yeah.
Rome. So here we have a story about somebody sitting amongst the elders of Rome who's really, really good at Kibbutz Av Va'Em, and that should create a certain amount of ambivalence towards us, right? What do we really think of a population which is really, really good at Kibbutz Av Va'Em? One of my colleagues on the history department, again, when we were asked, like, how did this play out in Roman culture, gave us, you know, a fun variety of laws that Rome allowed children, parents to engage in their children, which involves cutting off small body parts one at a time, you know, and executing them for disobedience and things like that. So Rome really was really good, really, really good at Kibbutz Av Va'Em, but it's not obvious that we wish to emulate their the centrality of Kibbutz Av Va'Em in their culture. That's one way out. But yes, Alicia?
I was wondering if the story of an extreme example of
Shittel Melata, losing. Okay. We could frame it as opportunity cost as opposed to principal cost.
Because he didn't lose the stone.
Right, because he still had the stones. Right, it's just an opportunity. Right, he probably had a unique buyer. Right, they were probably a unique buyer. they're willing to pay more for any meals, but it's really just opportunity cost, and we could come up with a purely technical thing that children cannot be required to pay principal, but they can be required to give up any opportunity cost. That's also a reasonable economic way of reading it.